Blog Talk Radio.
Delicious Talk. I'm your host, Gail Delicious Johnson, and today's show is entirely different from any show I've ever done because this is Cancer Awareness Month. This show is dedicated to the survivors of cancer or people who are living with cancer, and the reason I'm doing this show is because I've lost people that were close to me with cancer, including my mother who passed in 1995 from lung and brain cancer. I also declared today Hug a Stranger Day. While I was in the post office today, I helped an elderly woman fill out a slip for a change of address, and she thanked me, and I hugged her, and she looked at me, and she said, "You remind me so much of my daughter who died 10 years ago today from cancer." And she had water in her eyes. So that was very touching to me. You know, I'm always, you know, trying to be there for people, and this was a total stranger to me. But, you know, if you could do that for somebody, you never know what they're going through or what they've been through. And, you know, little hugs and little smiles and things like that to help people out. So the day isn't over. If you haven't hugged anybody, please do it. Hope everybody's having a beautiful Friday as well. My co-host is here, Rhea. How you doing, darling?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. And, you know, like I was explaining, today's show is entirely different from any show that we've ever done, you know, because it is Cancer Awareness Month. And you know, I want to talk a little bit about people who, you know, in my life who, you know, I either grew up with or, you know, someone I was involved with, and especially my mom, who I lost in 1995 to cancer. The first person I want to speak about was a young lady I grew up with back in the day. She had cervical cancer, and she was born in 1947. She died in 1996. I hadn't seen Irma in a few years when I, you know, found out that she did have cancer, and I found out because we was at a funeral of one of her children's father who had passed on, but he didn't die from cancer, but we were there, and we, you know, were talking, and she told me that she had had cancer, and it had went into remission. So, you know, I was feeling like, wow, you know, because I think my mom had died just before she had died. But anyway, and, you know, it was so strange because when we went out, when we left the funeral, she pulls out a pack of cigarettes. And I say to her, "So are you still smoking?" She said, "Well, it doesn't, you know, have anything to do with the cancer." So I said, "Oh, okay." You know, but her cancer went into remission. I think it had been in remission for maybe a year. And one day I got a phone call from her daughter who told me that she had passed. And I said, "Well, I thought the cancer went to remission." She said, "Yes, it did, but it came back. And when it came back aggressively. It attacked her bones. It just consumed her." When I went to the funeral, she was unrecognizable. She looked like she was, oh, my God, it had just ate her down to the bones. And she looked, oh, it was just like a skeleton, you know, in that coffin. And I really felt bad for her and, you know, her loved ones. And, you know, just it just took me back to when my mom had passed. And, you know, cancer is a disease that you can't live with cancer in your body. You may can live with AIDS in your body or these other diseases that they have medications and things like that that they could suppress it or whatever. But cancer, if it's not removed surgically or treated with medication, depending on the type of cancer it is, to go into remission or to actually get it out of your body, you're going to die from it. Because cancer attacks the vital organs and it consumes you. It eats you up from the inside out. And, you know, some people who, you know, and there's so many different cancers out there, you know, just so many cancers and so many causes of it. You can get it from the sun or foods you eat or the water, you know, just different things that causes that cancer to flare up in your body. Breast cancer. Women who get breast cancer, they can have a mastectomy and that gets rid of it. But if there's anything left in there, it'll metastasize, begin to grow again, and they may have to go in again. But, you know, it when it goes out and it comes back aggressively. And it can attack every organ in your body. That's what happened to my first friend, Irma Wally. So I just, you know, I'm just so hurt when people are, you know, attacked by this disease. Because I'll get into the story about my mom a little later on. But, you know, you lose your hair when you go through the chemo and the radiation. It makes you sick, the medication that they give you. You know, and it's just a horrible disease because when you get the chemo and the radiation, what it does is it kills all the cells in your body, including the good ones as well as the bad ones. So basically it's like a slow suicide when you have terminal cancer. And, You know, they're having these, you know, different things to raise money for the cure for cancer, raise money to buy wigs for cancer victims, and, you know, these different things that are going on to combat this horrible, horrible disease, you know. So, Rhea, do you know anybody or have anybody who was affected by cancer?
In our family, a cousin died about 12 years ago. She died from cancer, and then an aunt died from cancer a few years after her.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not very close to either of them, so I didn't see. I saw the cousin near the end.
Mm-hmm.
Hospital, and I saw the aunt during the times when she was fighting it, and you know, when she had to immobilize her arm because both of them had breast cancer, and my cousins metastasized, and you know, went through her lungs, and it just went through her, and my aunt eventually succumbed to cancer, but I never saw her get down low with it. And I happened to be traveling at the time that she passed and was mm-hmm. unable to make it back to the city in time for her funeral. So mm-hmm. I don't know how the end, but it's a horrible disease in so many ways. And it's so debilitating to the body. And
right.
With other diseases, it's not as bad as that. But any disease that you get that attacks your body and deteriorates your body, and your mind is still fully alert, and you can't function, you can't control your body, you can't function. It makes it so much harder to me, because they know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They can feel. My mom, for example, died 4 years ago, and she did not die from cancer. She died from renal failure,
mm-hmm.
with a secondary cause of hardening of the arteries.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother's death came about essentially at the time that it did, because of a drunk driver. Somebody
mm-hmm.
hit them in the car head on, and she had to be excavated from the car, and her hip was broken. And due to diabetes, her hip never healed. And at that
right.
point, she didn't want to have surgery. She
mm-hmm.
felt so slow. But that's not even here nor there. I just sit back. The only reason I brought her up for an example, because I saw her naturally from beginning to end. And when she kept stroking out, her mind was totally alert,
mm-hmm.
but she couldn't express herself. And the sorrow and the anger and the frustration and the depression and all that caused. And cancer tends to be one of those that does that same thing, because it just, no matter what they do, it just eats at that body and eats that body away. And from what I understand, there's a lot of pain associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
A humongous amount of pain. And it's just, it's horrible. That's one of those things that is truly horrible to me. And to have to be honest, that's one of my fears, I guess, only because that's something that's very hard to fight.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who do fight it. I have a girlfriend. I just thought about that, Jackie. I have a girlfriend who had found breast cancer, and then she had stomach cancer, and then she came back in her breast. And then at the end, now she died. My mother died September 2007. Jackie died mm-hmm. August 2007.
Wow.
2006. She called me and told me that she had 10 lesions, 10 tumors on her brain.
Mm.
And ultimately, her body was kind of saturated with it, and that caused her death. And it was interesting, the whole, you know, the dynamics around it. I didn't get to see her near the end because she stayed out very far from me, and my son was going to bring me. She didn't want nobody to see her because of what radiation and chemo had done to her.
Right.
And she would tell me I could come, and then she would tell me I couldn't come. And she, because she was a very vain person. And that's something that always struck me when, even as we were coming up. We met when I was pregnant with my first child and she was pregnant with her second. And so I had known her since I was 18 years old.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I had known her since I was 17 years old. And I just sit back and I haven't actually witnessed in any great detail anybody that have suffered through it, but I've heard of it. And I have a coworker who actually is having surgery on Monday because she has breast cancer. So it's like all the way around. And it seems like, and today, it just seemed like it's just so much, it's so many more people getting it than it was when I was, let's say, coming up.
Right. Right, because of the pesticides they're using, spraying the vegetables and the fruits with, and, you know, the tainted water, and, you know, it's horrible. You know, you even the sun, you know, so you have to be very, very mindful and careful what you're eating, how you're living your life, and, you know, you just have to be very careful. Because, not getting off the story of that, but I also, my sister-in-law's father had died from cancer, and he didn't smoke. His wife smoked. So they're surmising that he got it from her smoking, you know, because he was always around and she just smoked, and she eventually died from cancer as well. So, you know, from smoking cigarettes, cigars, and you know, then the pesticides from the fruits and the vegetables being sprayed with pesticides, and you know, then you land on a beach under the sun, and you know, you get skin cancer, and you know, it's just so many things that contributed to the fact of our bodies getting cancer. And I'm going to read a little something. What cancer is. Cancer, a cellular tumor, the natural course of which is fatal. Cancer cells, unlike benign tumor cells, exhibit the properties of invasion and metastasize and are highly anaplastic. Cancers are divided into two broad categories of carcinoma and sarcoma. So, that's cancer. You know, and I just wish that, you know, it was something that I could have done, you know, for my friend. But, you know, I lost contact with her, and then her daughter called me the day after she had died. And I'm saying, why didn't you call me all before and let me know when she was in the hospital, when she was sick, you know, so I could have went to see her? You know, why you wait till she's dead to call me and tell me this? You know, I really didn't, you know, I was very upset behind that. But then when I saw her in the coffin, it was, you know, it was just, that image still burns in my brain. You know, just see how she was just consumed by that cancer. And I'm going to read her obituary, if you don't mind. You don't mind, do you?
Oh, no.
Okay. Irma Patricia Wiley was born April 24, 1947, to Murray L. Williams and the late Thomas A. Williams. She departed this life on Friday, January 12, 1996, surrounded by her children in the comfort of her home. Irma was born in the District of Columbia, where she was educated in the D.C. public schools. She held several positions in the federal government, the district government, and in private industry. Irma will best be remembered by her friends and family as one who was always willing to share whatever she had with those in need, even at times when she could not afford to share. She never gave up on life. When life's daily challenges became difficult, Irma overcame them with dignity and pride. In the last days of her illness, she did no less. Irma was a fighter. And, you know, she had four devoted children. Her mother was living at the time, which her mother's dead now, and her father had been dead. But, you know, Irma was a good person, you know, and I knew her since I was, like, in my early 20s. And she died, I think she was in her 40s or something like that when she had died. But, you know, that's young. That is really young to die. And then to, you know, go out so horribly like that. So that's Irma. And then I had a conversation with someone, I have forgot, but we were talking about AIDS, and they were saying that they felt that AIDS was a form of cancer, but AIDS is not cancer. AIDS is a disease that attacks the immune system, and you can live with AIDS in your body with medication. So there is a difference between AIDS and cancer. And AIDS attacks the immune system. The immune system is what protects against infectious disease, either specific or inspecific mechanisms. That's what the immune system is. So once the immune system is attacked with the AIDS virus, anything that comes, like any sickness or cough or sneeze or anything, could cause someone to die because your immune system cannot fight it off. And you can get cancer. It's called, when you see people with these lesions on their skin, that's some type of a cancer. And, you know, it's fatal. But it's not, AIDS is not cancer. You understand what I just said? Or did I say that backwards?
Yeah, but you also get those lesions with AIDS too.
Right, that's what I have said. You get the lesions from AIDS. But so you know, just
why you just said that? Because you were talking about AIDS but you said cancer. That's why you confused yourself and said that. So you said cancer. Okay, now I understand what you were trying to say. Okay.
Right, okay. So if I didn't mean to confuse anybody out there, but so I'm glad you understood that, Dolly. But AIDS is pretty bad too, but, you know, like I said, you can live with that in your body through medication, but cancer cannot stay in your body. You can survive it because, number one, it will metastasize, gets bigger and bigger, and it'll consume you, and it'll just wipe you out. And when they give you that radiation and that chemo makes you sick. It makes you so sick, so weak. And, you know, because I worked in a hospital and I worked in a cancer institute for a few months, and some of those patients coming in there, getting that chemo, they'd be in there for hours and hours, and they would come out and they would just look so drained. And, you know, one lady came and she said, "I just feel so bad. I'll just be so glad when it's over," you know. But I don't know. Chemo is no better than the radiation, because the radiation takes all the hair off of your entire body. Every bit of it. So that's why they, you know, women's heads are bald, or children's heads are bald. They have no eyelashes, no eyebrows, no hair anywhere on your body. So, Rhea, So that was the only person that you known to have cancer?
Well, the closest person to me was my girlfriend, Jackie, and she actually died from it when she was 43, because I'm 2 years old. So, yeah, she died. She was 43 when she died from it. That I did have an aunt and a cousin that died from it, but we weren't, you know, as close. But I have never been in close contact and actually, you know, saw somebody going through it. I just saw the end, like I said, the end results of it.
Yeah, it's sad. It's so really sad.
Now, I'm going to tell you, my cousin was the second person that I knew personally that got cancer within 5 years of having infertility treatments.
Mm-hmm. And infertility treatments?
She had fertility treatments and had to have her daughter. And within for her, it was under 5 years. Because for her, it was like, the baby was like 3.5. And the reason she found her cancer, she was on the floor playing with her daughter, and her daughter swung and hit her, and happened to hit her on her breast. And it literally made her succumb to the floor. They had to help to get her up off the floor. It was just that much pain. And that was how, that's how she found the cancer. But, her baby was like 3, because it was that summer. So her baby was like 3.5. Then this lady I know who got fertility treatment got cancer when her child was 4. And I just wondered, I just wonder, is there any association with that? And it just so happened that somebody else, well, several people know of somebody, and one particular person, it happened with two of her sisters. And nobody had thought about that before then, but I just wonder, because see, what some people fail to realize is that cancer is in all of us.
Right.
There are cells that are gone awry. It's almost like they lay dormant until whatever happens, wake them up. And I wondered about that after seeing that happen, like I said, more than once. And I'm sure there's things that we do, like in regard to the smoker, the non-smoker and the living with the smoker. I know of two women who were bartenders, and neither one of them smoked, have never smoked a day in their life. Both of them died from lung cancer. But they had to get it secondhand. And their profession, you're in a bar. It wasn't until recently that couldn't smoke. So people were smoking in those. And that secondhand smoke is, they said that sometimes the people get it from the secondhand smoke quicker than they get it from the person who's actually smoking it.
Yeah, that's true.
They say, yeah.
That's
so
true.
Wow. That's why they talk about how bad it is to do smoke around children and this, that, and the other. But I found it very interesting, and I noticed they're not talking about it anymore. But last year, they had talked about, not last year, earlier this year, they had talked about putting pictures of cancerous organs on packs of cigarettes.
Right.
And then suddenly they shut up, but I'm sure that's because of big money. Tobacco industry, Lord knows they got some deep pockets backing them. But it's like, wow, really?
Mm-hmm. But see, they could never stop people from smoking regardless of whatever they put on a cigarette pack. What they need to do is stop making cigarettes, period.
Exactly.
That's the only way they can get people to stop smoking, because that's just like the gun laws. They have people that can have guns and people that can't have guns. But, hello, everybody gets the gun regardless. And the only way that's going to stop is don't make the gun. So you can't put on a pack of cigarettes somebody's lungs that's been ate up by cancer and expect somebody not to smoke cigarettes, especially if they've been a smoker for the 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. They're just going to look at that and say, well, got to go from something.
Exactly.
You know, so It needs to just stop. But, you know, like you said, those people got money. Those big tobacco companies, they have money to back them up, and they don't want those things on their cigarettes, and they're not going to have them on their cigarettes. You know, the warnings like they would have on cigarettes, on the side of cigarettes. Do you think people was reading them?
No.
They were not. So they say, well, we'll put pictures on there. The pictures are not going to, you know, make any difference either.
I was wondering. I kind of was wondering, would for someone who already smokes and has been smoking for a while, I can see. But I was wondering at one point, did they come up with that idea as maybe trying to deter people from starting, or, you know, especially young people, mm-hmm. you know, in their teens and this, that, and the other? Because you're right, for somebody who has smoked for numerous years, that's not going to have that much of an impact on them.
And then the fact of the matter, they're putting more addictive ingredients in these cigarettes to make people smoke, to get these people hooked on these cigarettes. That's not helping either.
That's true.
You know, because they're just putting more and more addictive ingredients into these cigarettes. And people are just getting so hooked on them until, you know, that's it. Even these young kids are smoking cigarettes. And once you get hooked, that's it.
That's true.
That's it. I remember I smoked for, I haven't smoked a cigarette in almost, let's see, since 85 or something like that. But I haven't smoked a cigarette. I can't even remember. I think 1985 was the last time I smoked a cigarette. But I had gotten to a point where I was smoking a pack a day, and I know that was too much because I was getting out of breath and I was stinking. Oh, my God. But I didn't realize until after I had stopped smoking. Because when you're smoking, you cannot smell nothing on you. And, you know, it's just like there's nothing there. But I remember when I would go out for my smoke breaks and I would come back in and people were saying, pew. I'd say, pew what? You stink. No, I don't. I just smoked a cigarette, you know. But now that I have stopped smoking, I can actually smell it on people. I was in a patient's room who had went out into the garden and smoked a cigarette. Just before they had stopped you can't even smoke on the hospital grounds now, but they had went outside and smoked a cigarette. She came back in that room. I almost passed out. It was sickening. And I said to myself, did I smell like that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. You know, but you don't know it until you step back. Because I didn't know that I was smelling like that. My house, my hair, my clothes, everything had that cigarette smell on it. And it's horrible.
Well, I smoked, and I never smoked a large quantity of cigarettes at all. Many a day. I didn't do nothing but a cigarette a day. But I enjoyed smoking.
I did too.
It was a pleasurable thing for me. And the reason I started giggling is because not too long ago, my children were together. And they bought up something that they bring up every now and then. I remember when Mommy used to smoke and get all nice. I can't help but laugh at that when they say she be smoking that cigarette and will be all nice. And it's like, and I know I used to smoke a half a cigarette in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a whole one, but usually it was a half a cigarette in the evening. I didn't smoke when I was at work. And every now and then I would smoke a half a cigarette in the morning. But I know that not too long ago, I almost went and bought me a pack of cigarettes.
Wow.
I just had that, and it's like, wow. And I haven't smoked a cigarette since August of 1995.
Mm.
And when I put it down, I didn't even think about putting them down. It just happened. And in August of 85, I mean, I'm sorry, in August of 1995, I don't know if I said 85 before, but it was 95. When I stopped smoking, my life did a change because I walked away from my marriage that month. I stopped smoking. I just did some changing in my life that month. And when I stopped smoking, like I said, it wasn't planned because I really only smoked when I wanted to. And I didn't have the craving to smoke or anything. And then when I walked away from my marriage, I walked away from my mother's home and was basically homeless. And I was going into a house with two sisters who didn't smoke, and smoking wasn't allowed in their house. And I was not, and we were sneaking too, because, you know, you're not supposed to have nobody else in your house that's not on your lease. So I couldn't stay inside and smoke. So I ended up not doing it. And then in January of 96, I was diagnosed with bronchitis. Mm-hmm. And I knew then that I would never, I won't say never in this case. I knew then that I wouldn't pick them back up. I've had an urge a couple of times, and recently I got a really, really big urge, and I've been trying to think and figure out what triggered that, but I haven't been able to.
Well, you know, I used to have a habit of, when I got up, the first thing I did before I even brushed my teeth in the morning was to smoke a cigarette. Smoke a cigarette, then, you know, I get ready for work. And depending on if I was driving to work or whatever, I smoke a cigarette before I get to work. Then getting to work, smoke a cigarette on every break that we got. You know, then come home and, you know, be cooking dinner, smoking a cigarette, you know. And I'm just saying, and then when I would go to the bathroom, smoke a cigarette, drink coffee, smoke a cigarette. So what you really have to do is you have to break those habits of how when you was things you was doing, like, for instance, getting up in the morning, instead of grabbing a cigarette, maybe grab a piece of gum, you know, or when you drink a cup of coffee, you know, have maybe a cracker or something there to eat, you know, break those ways that each time you smoke a cigarette to, you know, not do those same things, because once it's a habit, those habits become hard to break, and then it's an addiction too, you know. So you have two things working against you, so you really have to, you know, be mindful and think, well, let me see, when I get up in the morning, I'm not going to smoke no cigarette. You get up in the morning, you smoke a cigarette, so you know that you're not on your way. But how I stopped smoking cigarettes was because, like I said, when I started smoking a pack a day, and then I was having my breathing was labored, and I get tired going up steps, and I'm saying, oh no. And I wasn't even the size that I am now. I was not, you know, I was maybe like 135 pounds or something like that. And I'm just saying, why? You know, I shouldn't be out of breath, you know, going up the steps. So what I did one day, I came home from work. I had a pack of cigarettes, and I'm in there smoking a cigarette. So then I said, I don't want to smoke anymore. So I balled the cigarettes up and put them in a trash can, right? So I'm getting ready to go to bed, and I said, oh, Lord, I'm having this urge. So I go in the trash, get the cigarettes out, and put them together and smoke it. So I'm saying, why am I doing this? So I put the cigarette out, and I balled it, you know, balled the pack up, and I took it outside and put it in a dumpster. So I said, I know I ain't going to be going to no dumpster trying to get no cigarettes. That's a no-no. So that first day, you know, after, you know, when I went to work and everybody was going out on their break, and I'm saying, should I go out here? Because I know they're going to be out here smoking. So I said, well, I'm going to go to the lunchroom. So I went to the lunchroom and, you know, stayed up there for a minute until the break was over. And I went back down. I said, why you ain't come outside? I said, because I was in the lunchroom, you know. But the second day, it wasn't too bad as the first day, because the first day, I'm just climbing the walls. So by the third day, I could not stand the smell of a cigarette. I could not stand it. And at one point, when I went outside with the girls when they were smoking, I almost asked the girl, I said, give me a drag. Then I thought about it. I said, I hadn't smoked in those 3 days. So then I said, she was getting ready to hand me the cigarette, and I said, that's all right, girl, I'm only kidding. So she said, no, you can go on. You want a cigarette? I said, no. You know, so it took a while, and with prayer mm-hmm. works. I'm telling you, because I begged God to please take this craving from me. Please, I do not want to be short of breath. I don't want to be sick. I just begged and pleaded and prayed and prayed and prayed until eventually the day came when, you know, cigarettes didn't even cross my mind at all. And it wasn't easy. I'm not going to say it like it was an easy thing to do because, like, I was addicted to these cigarettes. You know, so I had to pray to get that addiction out, that habit. It was really crazy. But I'm glad that it didn't stir up any of the cancer cells that are in my body.
Yeah.
Or cause me to have any type of bronchitis and asthma and different things that it also brings on, you know, smoking brings on. And, you know, it was an uphill climb, but I made it. Made it right on to the top. So we're going to take a little break and come back with my next friend.
Never would have made it. Never could have made it without you. I would have lost it all. But now I see how you were there for me, and I can say, never would have made it. Never could have made it without you. I would have lost it all. But now I see how you were there for me, and I can say I'm stronger, I'm wiser, I'm better, much better. When I look back over all you brought me through,
I'm wiser.
I'm better. Somebody just needs to testify to somebody next to them. Tell them, I'm strong. I'm wise. I'm better. Much better. When I look back over what he brought me through, I realize I made it because I had you to hold on to. Now I'm stronger. Now I'm wiser. I'm better. So much better. I made it. Is there anybody in this house other than me that could declare you made it? Tell your neighbor, never would have made it.
Never would have made it.
Tell them, never could have made it.
Never could have made it without you.
Oh, I wish I had some help here. I wish I had just two or three people that would just declare it. Never would have made it.
Never would have made it.
Never could have made it.
Never could have made it.
I just love to encourage myself. Sometimes I just look in the mirror and say, I'm stronger. I'm wise. I am better. So much better. When I look back over what he brought me through, I realize I made it because I had you to hold on to. But I never would have made it. I never could have made it without you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lord. Oh, good God Almighty, never would have made it.
Never would have made it.
Never could have made it. Singing one more time. All I need is just one more time. Everybody say with me.
Never would have made it.
Oh, oh, oh.
Never could have made it without
you. Oh, hello. Sorry, I had the mute button on. Excuse me. That's Marvin Sapp. Never would have made it. Okay, we're going to get right into my next friend who succumbed to cancer. She died, as a matter of fact, in 2010, October the 10th. That's the day after my birthday. She was born March the 14th, 1949. And this young lady, we grew up in the projects together. And as a matter of fact, for you, you guys who are listening don't know, I am an author and a poet as well, and among other things. But she's in a couple of my books. My first book was Past Is Not Forgotten, and the sequel, The Reunion. This girl could dance. I mean, she hand danced like, I mean, she won competitions hand dancing. And the reason I put her in the book is because she just was a phenomenal person. Her dancing, it was just off the chain. And like I said, she won competitions. And she was a funny person as well. We called her Plumie. Plumie had a heart of gold. She was just so sweet, you know, growing up. She had three sisters and a brother. And one of her sisters died from sarcoidosis a few years ago. But Plumie was, well, when she found out she had the cancer, was it was really kind of late into it because she had been complaining of pains in the stomach and being sick. And when I had finished the first book, I had called her and I had saw her at a reunion. Let me back that up. So at one of the reunions that we generally have every year. And she was always looking good. She had white hair. She's always, her hair has always been white, even when we were young. But she had dyed it, you know, back in the day because she didn't want her hair that color. But her hair was just beautiful. And I saw her and I told her, she said, I heard you wrote a book. I said, yes. She said, am I in it? I told her, I said, yes. She said, I'm in it? I said, yes. I said, but your name is not in there. But in the book, she's the character Summer.
Oh.
And, yeah, so I told her that, and she was just so happy. And every time that I tried to get a book to her, she said, well, I'll come over and pick it up. So I said, well, where? I said, I can bring it to you. She said, no, I'm going to be out today, and I'll come and pick it up. So I didn't hear from her that day, and I called her. So she said, well, I had to go do something for my mom because her mom had surgery on her foot. Her mom's a diabetic, and she had her foot, part of her foot amputated, so she was dealing with her mom. So I said, well, I can bring it to you, Plumy. I can bring the book to you. She said, well, no, I'm going to be going out tomorrow, and I'll stop by tomorrow. The next day, I didn't see or hear from her. So I'm calling and calling and calling, just getting an answer in service. And I'm saying, you know, what in the world is going on? I knew she had complained that she had doctor's appointments and she had had to retire from a job early because of some illnesses. But, you know, it didn't seem like it was anything serious because she never said, you know, that it was anything serious. But so anyway, I'm calling and, you know, leaving messages and calling, leaving messages. So finally, I don't know who, I think it was her sister. No, let me back that up. No, it was a friend, a mutual friend of ours had called me and told me that she was in hospice. And that's like the end of the line when you go to hospice. So I said, well, what happened? You know, so then he told me that she had been going in and out of the hospital. This is why I couldn't catch up with her. She had been going in and out of the hospital, and they did exploratory surgery on her, and that's when they discovered the cancer in her stomach. But she didn't want any type of treatment. She didn't want to get chemo or the radiation or anything. She was being very defiant with the doctors, and she wanted to go home. So she went home, and eventually I guess it got worse. So because, like, I got the tail end of it when she was in hospice. And it was my birthday, October the 9th, like I said, was my birthday, and I had went to visit my sister earlier in the day, and I said, well, since I'm up this way, I'm going to go see Plumy. So I get in the car, and I think a parade or something was going on that day, but the traffic was terrible. So I was saying to my, and plus it was hot. So I said, you know what, I'm going to have to go see her tomorrow. But a little voice kept telling me, go see her today. So I said to myself, okay, I'm going to go. So I just patiently drove until I finally got there. Got in the place, went to her room, and I mean, I was just, it was just so sad to see her like that. She had oxygen on, and she was, I guess, not conscious, but she was breathing, but her breathing was so labored. And, you know, at one point I'm saying to myself, please don't die while I'm in this room, because she was taking those long breaths, and then all of a sudden she wasn't, no air or anything, and I just kept saying, God, please don't let her die, don't let her die. So I'm, you know, standing there holding her hand, talking to her, and, you know, just crying because I'm feeling so bad and so hurt to see my friend, you know, in the position that she was in and the predicament she was in. So I had taken a book to the hospital, to hospice, and I had autographed it to her. And I asked her sister, you know, would they mind putting it in the coffin with her? You know, when, well, I didn't ask till after that. But anyway, so I stayed up there for a couple of hours, and another friend had came up. So we were talking, and so I left. And I was really glad that I had went to see her, because about 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call. I'm saying, who in the world is calling me at this hour of the morning? So I answered the phone, and it was her sister. And she said, Pumi just passed. And I said, oh, my God. You know, but I am glad that I did get to see her before she did pass. You know, because I had gone up there, I was ready to turn around and come home and say that I was going to go the next day. But, you know, that little voice said, you better go today.
Exactly.
And, yeah, and I'm really glad that I did. So she's, like I said, I had, you know, wrote her in the book before she, you know, was sick and everything. Because when you read about her in the first book, and then the second book is a conclusion of her life. But, you know, she is truly missed, and she was a wonderful person. And like I said, this girl could dance. I mean, I remember one time we had went to the Howard Theater, and this is in the book. We had went to the Howard Theater to see James Brown, I think it was. And so her and her partner, they got up, they got to dancing all in the aisles, and so the usher told them to sit down. So they sat down, they kept getting up, kept getting up. So finally they just told them they had to get out. Do you know that they actually danced out the door?
Oh, wow.
She said, whatever. So she just got up, just danced out the door. But this girl could dance. I mean, she could really dance. And, you know, doing the hand dancing.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's my friend Ellen. I'm going to read a little bit of her obituary as well. Ellen Glendora Wallace, affectionately known to family and friends as Plumie, was born March the 14th, 1949, and departed this earth on October the 10th, 2010, after a long illness. Daughter of John William Wallace and Annie Elizabeth Wallace, Ellen was born and raised in Southeast Washington, D.C., where she was educated in D.C. public schools and attended Federal City College, now the University of the District of Columbia, where she majored in business administration. Ellen started her career with the D.C. Public Library System and later moved on to the Internal Revenue Service. After a few years, Ellen changed her career to become a legal secretary and worked for several well-known law firms. Ellen was joined in holy matrimony with Maurice Whitener, and from this union, one child, Sharita, was born. Ellen was faithful servant at Eden Community Baptist Church in 2002. In 2000, she became a member of the Rising Sun Baptist Church, where she served as a deaconess board, helping hands, club, RSVP choir, and other auxiliaries. Ellen was known for her dancing and dressing. In 2007, her health began to decline, and it says who she's preceded in death by, and it has a whole collage of pictures, and, you know, it was just so heartfelt losing her. It even had pictures on her when her hair is silver back in the day, too. But, you know, she was a person that would definitely keep you laughing, always put a smile on your face, and whenever you see her, she greets you with a smile. Just a beautiful person. But she's gone, but definitely not forgotten. And, you know, like I said, she is the character in my book. So if you want to know any more about Summer, purchase my book. We're going to take a break and come back with the next person, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. to eat, but always keep that hunger. May you never take one single breath for granted. God forbid love ever leave you empty-handed. I hope you still feel small standing by the ocean. Whenever one door closes, I hope one more opens. Promise me you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance. I hope you never fear those mountains in the distance, and never settle for the path of least resistance. Living might mean taking chances, but they're worth saving. Loving might be a mistake, but it's worth the making. Your system held it hard, leave you bitter. When you come close to selling out,
let's say we just head north.
Give the heavens above more than just a passing glance. And when you get the choice to spit it out or dance, whenever one door closes, I hope one more opens. Promise me that you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I wanna tell you time.
That's Gladys Knight, and I hope you dance.
You still feel small when you stand beside the ocean. Whenever wonder closes, I hope one more. Promise me you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you have the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance.
Oh, okay. That's Gladys Knight, I Hope You Dance. That piece is so beautiful. This next...
It really is.
Yes. Yes, that was in the movie, The Family That Prays, The Family That Prays Together. Or I think, well, the movie that Tyler Perry did. But my good friend, Reggie Dennis, who I grew up in the projects with as well, we did a show last year, I think it was, on him on a different program, a different radio, blog talk radio show that I used to be a co-host of, and he asked me to play that song because, you know, instead of sitting it out, dance, you know, because Reggie was one of the guys in Knox. And as a matter of fact, he was the only guy that I grew up in the projects with that I had a crush on. Reggie also is a character in my book. And in my first book, he's a character. I use a fictitious name. But in my second book, his name is in the book. I got his permission to do that. You know, just before he died, but unfortunately my book was not completed when he died. He died that's when the service was. He died December the 19th of 2010. But Reggie was the type of guy, you know, because he was so different than all the other guys in the project. He was one of the guys who would, you know, help you with your bags. Not to say the other guys didn't, but it was just something about Reggie that was, to me, you know, he was so, he had manners and he was so attentive. And, you know, he was just a really all about nice guy. And throughout the years, I've never, ever known him to change. He's always been the same up until the day he died. And he moved away. He got married, and him and his wife settled in Colorado. And I went out there. I went out there to see him twice. But Reggie and I, we always, always kept in touch. Basically by the phone, you know, a few times we wrote letters, but we did more of our communicating on the phone. And we would talk for hours and hours and hours about everything. And, you know, things that was happening here, if I didn't know anything about it, I could call Reggie and he knew exactly what was going on here, and I'm here and didn't know it. You know, so he... And also, he was the one who had encouraged me to get my book published because, you know, like I said, I had been writing since forever, but, you know, I never had the intentions of getting it published because, number one, I didn't know how to go about it. But he always told me, he said, you should get your book published, you know, because I was, you know, I would read excerpts to him or send him excerpts, and he would always tell me, you know, how good it was and, you know, if anything was wrong with it, he'd let me know that too. You know, we were more or less like sister and brother, you know. But like I said, coming up, I had a crush on Reggie. And I didn't reveal it to him until we were grown. And I think it was way after, because he had come here for one of the reunions from Colorado. And I think at that particular time, I Yeah, him and his wife, they were still married, but, you know, just sitting around talking. And he said, well, why you didn't tell me back then? I said, because all the time I always thought that, you know, he had girlfriends. But, you know, he said they were basically friends, but, you know, I don't try to step on anybody else's toes. And when I went out there, he treated me like a queen. His wife and him and his wife, they had this big house. And Reggie, they never had children because neither one of them wanted to have children. So they had this great big house and this dog named Sugar. And Reggie would, you know, take me around, you know, around the town. He took me to this park, and this park where that's a beautiful park. And Colorado is a beautiful place. It is so beautiful there, you know. And I, you know, not to say that it didn't have homeless people there, but you know how you can go, you can't even go a mile within D.C. without seeing a homeless person, somebody standing on the corner begging for something. But in Colorado, if they had any homeless people, I'm not saying that they did or they didn't, but the times I went out there, I didn't see them, at least not in Denver, Colorado. And, you know, the weather changes so quickly out there, because when I went out that morning, it was like 70-some degrees. And I went downtown, you know, because he told me what bus to get and how to get back. I went downtown. When I came back, it was raining, and it was about 30-some degrees outside. You know, the weather really changes up there. But it's just, I thought about when I retiring to move out there, but things have changed up since then. But Reggie had... was into real estate, and he wrote three books, and he was in the process of writing another book. And the story of that fourth book that he was writing, it was about this couple, because he had told me it was about this couple, and I think it was the girl or the guy, one of them had said they had had cancer. But this was long before he had was even, you know, told me about the cancer. But when he had told me that he had the cancer, it was like, oh, my goodness. I think I took it harder than he did, you know, because he was so matter-of-fact about it. Well, he had told me that he was having problems with his stomach. And so he was going to the doctors, and, you know, they did these tests, and they were supposed to let him know when the test came back. So I said, well, what do you think it might be? He said, I don't know. He just had this real bad sharp pain in his stomach, and it wouldn't cease. So within a short while, he called me, and he told me that they found a spot on his liver. So I'm saying to myself, wow, you know, I hope it's not cancer. And this is all I'm saying to myself, because I didn't want to say it to him. So then he said they was going to do a biopsy. They did a biopsy, and it was discovered that it was cancer of the liver. So he went to the doctor, and I asked him, you know, well, you know, what are you going to do? So he said that he talked to he talked to a cancer specialist, and he told him that, you know, you could get the treatment or you don't have to get the treatment. He said, he explained to him what the treatment would do, and so Reggie made the decision not to get the treatment because, you know, like I spoke before, what those treatments do is basically it's like a slow death. You know, so then he said he was going to go the holistic way. But, you know, Reggie, he did it for a minute, but I guess he, you know, was so used to, you know, eating foods the way he, you know, had been eating them, and then he was still smoking cigarettes, and then he had got on the medical marijuana. And then the whole time Reggie's still working and, you know, getting around, and he was supposed to have been coming back here within a couple of weeks. He's supposed to be coming back here in September, I think it was. but he never made it. He some things that came up, so he never made it. So eventually, you know, I'm calling him, still talking to him, and at times I could tell that he was getting weaker. And, you know, I'm just going through this emotional time of, you know, not wanting him to go. So we, eventually he said that, you know, he was ready to die. You know, and I'm saying, oh, my God. So I said, well, Reggie, what about people who don't want you to die? Because I don't want you to die. You know, if you want to do the holistic thing, do it, you know. He said, no. He said, because, you know, he said, I lived a full life and I did everything that I wanted to do. He said that what he really, the last thing he wanted to do before he did die, though, he wanted to go on a cruise. He just wanted to go on a cruise by himself. That's what his last, you know, what he really wanted to do before he died. He never got to do that. So I, you know, we kept talking. I kept, you know, in contact with him. So he got to a point where he was getting sicker and weaker. So he went to stay with his wife. I don't know if I had mentioned him and his wife had gotten divorced, but anyway, his wife, you know, they were civil about everything because, you know, he still would go over there. She would cook for him, and, you know, he spent the nights over there. And when I went to stay out there, I stayed at his place, and he stayed at her place. And, you know, they were very civil, you know. They were still friends, still buddies. And, you know, I truly believe that Yolande still loved him, and I know that he loved her. But it was things that Reggie told me, the reason why they got a divorce, and, you know, that was it. But he went to stay with her, and he would call me a few times, and we would talk. And the last time I talked to Reggie, he was really, really, really weak, really weak. So then his sisters and his brothers, they, you know, made a trip to Colorado. And I got the phone call. He was dead. And, you know, I sometimes I can't even really believe that he's dead because, you know, I really didn't get to see him. And he said he didn't want a funeral. He didn't want an obituary in the paper and all that kind of stuff. He just wanted his wife to have him cremated and to spread his ashes in that beautiful park out there that he took me to. Half of them out there and half of them, the other half here in D.C. and Knox, where we grew up at. So his, you know, like I said, his sister's family went up there and got that phone call. He was dead. They had a memorial service here for him. It was so beautiful. They had pictures of him everywhere. And I did my little speech. And Reggie, I still can't believe it because sometimes I'd be sitting here and, you know, thinking about him because this would be around the hours I would call him because they're 2 hours behind us and we would talk. One time we talked until about 4 o'clock in the morning. But there it was 2 o'clock, but it was 4 o'clock here. And I'm telling you, I really miss Reggie. I really do. But he succumbed to cancer as well, liver cancer. And he's gone. My good friend is gone. But he'll forever remain in my heart. I also wrote another story that's dedicated to Reggie in my book of delicious erotic short stories, and it's called The Last Boat Ride, and that's dedicated to my friend Reggie Dennis. And I'm going to read his obituary as well. Reginald Reggie was born on January 12, 1949 in Washington, D.C. to the late Christopher and Geraldine Dennis. He was educated in D.C. public schools, graduating from Phelps Vocational High School, where he was a track star, running in the Penn Relays every year. He continued his education at the Federal City College and at Elton College in Burlington, North Carolina. In 1974, he married Yolande Brower and relocated to North Carolina and later to Denver, Colorado, where he remained until his death. Reggie enjoyed traveling, skiing, and all sports. He enjoyed coming home and hanging out with his childhood friends, Sam, Pudgy, Andre, Horse, and others. Reggie started his employment career with the Urban Institute here in Washington, D.C., and later working in Denver with various youth programs. Reggie was also an accomplished writer, having self-published 3 books. Reggie was baptized and confirmed member of the Mount Olive Lutheran Church. He last attended Mount Olive in September 2009 at the wedding of his sister, Christine. Reggie departed this life on December 19, 2010, after a brief illness. He leaves to mourn in his passing his loving and devoted wife, Yolande. Then it's his brothers and sisters and a couple of nephews. But like I said, Reggie's gone, but he'll forever remain in my heart. And I'm really sorry that I didn't tell him that I had a crush on him, because maybe I could have been Miss Reggie Dennis. Yeah, so I have one more person that I'm going to get out there, but we're going to take another break and come back, and we'll do this last person. Okay, Rhea?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
Cleveland, and I think the All-Star Choir, God Is. Okay, the last person that I'm going to speak of that I lost to cancer is my mother. My dear mom. She died April 11th, 1995. She was born August 28th, 1925. My mom's cancer was from smoking and drinking coffee. Nicotine and caffeine is what killed my mom. She actually literally smoked and drank herself to death. I remember my mom smoking for as long as I can remember, and she died when I was like 45, 46, 47, something like that. And she's always drank coffee for as long as I can remember. Get up in the morning, have her coffee and her cigarettes. I rarely saw my mom drink anything other than coffee. Now, she used to drink RC. That was a soda way back in the day, Royal Crown Cola soda. But coffee, that was her guilty pleasure, and she drank it black. So, like I said, my mom was diagnosed in 1995 with brain cancer and lung cancer. The survival rate of a person with lung cancer, if it's not treated or surgically removed, is generally 5 years. And we noticed around in 1990 we was on a picnic and my mom just passed out. She just passed out. So we took her to the hospital and they did blood work, EKG, this, that, you know, just the whole gamut of everything. And they couldn't find anything wrong with her. So she goes home, and, you know, everything's back to normal. And she started losing weight. You know, we noticed that she was losing weight, but we thought it was because my mom was very active. Every day she was walking or in the garden. You know, she was always doing something, and she, you know, was eating properly. So we just thought it was from her walking and, you know, how she was eating. But then her and my brother was out one day, and she passed out again. And they took her to a different hospital. Now, when they took her to this hospital, she was in there for maybe a week because they was doing tests and, you know, observing her, you know, because we had told her that what had happened before, she had passed out before. And my sister had went to see her, and my sister told us this was, I think, after my mom had passed, but she said that my mother had told her that she had brain cancer. And she hadn't been diagnosed. They didn't do any, you know, tests or anything to look for any type of cancers or anything, but that's what my sister said my mom had told her. So it wasn't until, like I said, all that happened in 1990, and then she passed out again. So finally, in 1994, when she had passed out again, she went to the hospital, and they did X-ray, and they saw spots on her brain and on her lungs. So they did a biopsy, and we got the horrible news that it was cancer. So this doctor that my mom had, it was some foreign quack. He didn't care anything about my mom's condition. He didn't care about my mom, you know, and it was very frustrating to know, because we knew that the cancer was terminal, because she had had it for 5 years, and it was just metastasized from her brain to her lungs. And then her lymphoids, I mean, the cancer was just consuming her. So the doctor said that she'll have headaches and she might lose her speech, this and that, all these things he was saying that, you know, was going to happen because of the cancer. But she didn't have the headaches and she didn't lose her speech. My mother never even really lost the will to live, because a lot of people give up. They say, well, I just want to die. Let me go. I can't take it. But my mom was more or less every day, she would say, when I get better, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, you know, I want to do this. Not once did my mother ever say, I'm so sick, I want to die. You know, she never had that attitude, never. And but we eventually got her away from that quack doctor. We got her to a better doctor. And he told us that, you know, the cancer was terminal. And but because the first doctor had predicted when she was going to die, this doctor said, well, I can't say when she's going to die, but the cancer is terminal. So that was a better pill to swallow instead of a doctor telling you she's going to be dead any day. So my mom, she was like a person. She's very independent. You know, she always did things for herself. But, you know, it got to a point where my mom couldn't even hold her her bowels. She had to wear a pamper, and she got I think two or three treatments of radiation. All her hair came out. Then they wanted to give her the chemo. When I went to see my mom, when they gave my mom that chemo, my mother was so sick. She was so sick until I literally became sick. Just seeing her like that, just throwing up and can't even hold her head up, you know, it just made me literally sick to see my mom in that condition. And she refused it from that point on. And she did her living will, you know, because at times when a person codes, they do CPR and they try to bring them back. And I've seen that is just a vicious, vicious procedure. I've been in a patient's room where the nurse has actually broken their ribs doing CPRs on these patients. And my thing is, why are you going to bring a person back to suffer? If you could bring them back and they're going to be well and good to go, I can understand that. But, you know, my mom said she didn't want to go through that. She did not want them to do no surgery. She did not, if she coded, she just wanted to go. And we was all right with that because, like I said, I had seen those procedures. and then bring somebody back to suffer, to continuously suffer. You know, my brother, you know, he didn't understand it, but when I had explained it to him, you know, he accepted it. But, you know, if I had never known anything about it, you know, I probably would have said, well, Mom, why don't you just let them do the CPR on you?
Mm.
But that procedure is very vicious, vicious, and it's violent. And then bring a person back to continuously suffer. So anyway, she was still getting around, and, you know, we were still going out. And I remember I took her to one of her doctor's appointments, and I was getting ready to, you know, pull up, you know, drop to take her in the house. And she says, I can't wait to get better so I can get my license and I could, you know, drive myself around. And I said, what, you don't want to go in the house? She said, no. So I just, you know, we just drove around looking at different sites in the city. And I had planned on taking my mom on a cruise for my birthday that particular year. But, like, you know, I just read to you guys, she died on April the 11th. So she's in the hospital, and she had a home health care person to come out and be with her. And when I got off work, I would go down there and stay until my brother got home. And we had taken my mom to a holistic doctor at one point, just before she had gotten this bad off, you know, a little late on. But when we had taken her to the doctor, she was kind of like she couldn't walk. So my brother had to, like, carry her out of the doctor's office. So we took her to this holistic doctor. And he fixed up some herbs for her to drink and was doing a consultation. When I looked at my mom, my mother's face was glowing when she drank those herbs down, and she walked out of that doctor's office. Mm. She walked out of his office. So we had, you know, continued to give her the herbs, but it was to a point where I think there wasn't any hope because of the simple fact it had consumed her, both her lungs, her lymph nodes, and then it was on her brain. But she didn't get the headaches and things like that, you know, like this other doctor had predicted, because one time I asked my mom, she was just laying in the bed, and I was laying next to her, so I said, Mom, how you feel? Do you have a headache? Because she wasn't saying anything. So she said, no. She said, no, I don't have a headache. So I said, are you sure? She said, I know when I have a headache, and when I don't have a headache, I don't have a headache. I said, okay, because I really didn't want my mom to suffer. I did not want her to suffer at all. So another strange thing that had taken place was my mom had had my oldest sister to call the church, and we were all Catholics. Well, baptized Catholic, but I don't practice Catholicism. But anyway, we were all Catholic. So she had my sister to call the church and ask for Father Tony. Now, my mother, I don't ever remember my mother going to church. You know, she would always send us on Sunday. So she had called, told my sister to call the church and ask for Father Tony so he could come over and give her last rites. So anyway, the priest had called, and I answered the phone, and he said, may I speak with Jean Johnson? That's my mom's name. So I said, well, she's asleep right now. I said, who's calling? He said, this is Father Tony. So then I said, did you meet my mom in the hospital? You know, so he said, no. He said, I don't know your mother. So I said, huh? He said he never met my mother, never talked to her, but his name was Father Tony, and he was the priest that my mother told my sister to call to the church and tell to come because she wanted to receive her last rites. And I asked my mom when she woke up, I said, Mom, I said, a Father Tony had called here for you. I said, where do you know him from? So she said, why are you trying to get in my business? said, I'm not trying to get in your business, Ma. I said, but he said he don't know you. So she never said anything. Never said anything about it. But it was so strange. So he came over the next night, and, you know, he, you know, I guess he prayed with her and gave her last rites. And in a couple of weeks, she had went into the hospital because fluid had, consuming her body as well, and she was having problems breathing, and she was in the hospital maybe for about, she went in that Saturday, and she died that Monday or Tuesday, because when we went up to the hospital, the doctor had met us up there, and my mom had told the doctor that she didn't want to die in the hospital, and she didn't want to die in hospice, that she wanted to die at home. And see, my mother never told us that, but she had told the doctor that, so he was making arrangements for her to go home the next day. But unfortunately, she died that night, and me and my sister, you know, stay. Everybody else, you know, had went home because it was like, really, we had been called at a meeting up at the hospital, and it was about 11 or 12 o'clock. So everybody had went home. So me and my sister was still there. And for some reason, a nurse kept coming in and out of the room every 5 and 10 minutes. So I'm on one side of the bed, my sister's on the other side of the bed. And I keep looking, I see the bag, the oxygen bag going up and down, but it's going very slow, very slow. So then I'm just sitting there, and I'm just praying, you know, just asking God, I mean, just telling God, you know, just thanking him for, you know, letting my mom be my mom for the years that she was, and letting him know that I loved her. And, you know, I'm sorry that she had to leave the way she did. So the last time the nurse came in the room, I turned around and the bag had stopped moving. So I asked the nurse, I said, she's dead, isn't she? She said, well, I can't say that. The doctor, you know, would have to do that. So, I realized that, you know, the doctor would have to declare him dead, but she knew that she was dead, and I knew she was dead. So, you know, we were asked to leave the room. The doctor came in and declared her dead. And she was buried on my daughter's birthday, which was April the 19th, which that was a happy day for me and a sad day as well. A happy day because, you know, my daughter was born that day, and a sad day because my mom was being buried that day. But needless to say, it took me a while to get over the fact that my mom was dead. I found myself picking up the phone, calling her a few times, and, you know, just getting ready to go over to her house when I left work. And then I would say, wait a minute, she's dead. You know, it just didn't resonate with me, you know. And I was so messed up behind it until I had to see a psychologist. I couldn't go to work. I was all out of work for a month. You know, because I really was not accepting that my mom was dead. So eventually I accepted it, and I know that, well, I knew it all along, but just accepting it was another thing. And, you know, me and my mom, we had our ups and downs and our ins and outs, like, you know, I guess any family does have with their children. But before my mom died was the first time I ever heard my mom tell me that she loved me. And when she said that, I really didn't want her to go. I really did not want her to go, because hearing her say that she loved me after all the years of me being on this earth, you know, and to hear her say that on her deathbed, it was, I can't really describe that feeling to this day. But I miss my mom. Hopefully we will see each other again. And anybody out there who knows someone who is suffering from cancer or has lost someone to cancer, my condolences go out to you. Women, get your mammograms and get your pap smears, and, you know, be careful about what you eat, and, you know, people who are around you who smoke, you know, be a little bit more mindful of taking care of yourself, because cancer, it ain't nothing nice at all. It is not nice. So that concludes this evening's program, Cancer, the Killer Monster. Rhea, do you have any closing remarks?
No, I'm just resonating. It's interesting, and you end up with your mom. Yesterday was the 4th anniversary of us burying mine. And I just, so I'm already there. But I compliment your music selection tonight.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, as a matter of fact, that song that I just played, James Cleveland, was a song we played at my mom's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of the songs when you know you have a musical selection, and I think that song is so beautiful. You know, so I want to thank everybody who came out, everybody who was in the chat room. I didn't have the chat room up, but if you came out and you're listening, flies on the wall or whatever, I appreciate that. I appreciate you, Rhea. And
thank
our
you.
Next, you're welcome, darling. Our next show, October 14th, as you well know, this also is Domestic Violence Month. And I was on the internet, you know, just seeing all these different little videos and clips of women being abused and, you know, beat up and burnt up and cut up. And, you know, not to say that men aren't abused as well, but it's more prevalent with women. So, you know, if you're out there abusing somebody, take a deep breath and go for a walk or get away from that person, you know, because we're not meant to be beat up and kicked around and, you know, forced to do things we don't want to do. We're made to be held and kissed and treated like the queens we are, you know. So on the 14th, I'm going to have two young ladies, Elizabeth Funderburt and Rhea, let me know if I'm pronouncing this other young lady's name correctly. Kiesa?
Yeah, Kaisa, yeah.
Kaisa, okay, Kaisa
uh-huh.
Rodriguez. They're going to be on the 14th, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and they are the directors of Saving Lives Through Literature. So you don't want to miss that show if you've been abused or know someone who has been abused or is in an abusive relationship. Come on back next Friday, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you might even pick up some information as to how you can get help or, you know, what to do in a situation when you're being abused. I've been in an abusive relationship myself, and I promised I'd never be in another one. If I saw any red flags going up, I was going the other way. So that's a show you don't want to miss. And I also have a young man that's coming on the 28th, Tori Scott. He's a author and an erotic poet, so you don't want to miss that show as well. With that being said, I'm just going to close the show out. Rhea, you have a beautiful weekend, and this is a long weekend because of the holiday Monday, right?
Girl, we don't get Columbus Day.
Oh, you don't?
They don't celebrate Columbus Day at our university.
Okay. Oh, so you have to work Monday. Okay, well, the rest of you guys that are having a long weekend, be safe. Don't drink and drive. Don't drive and drink. And remember, never look down on a man unless you're going to help him up. With that being said, everybody have a good night. Good night, Rhea.
Good night, and you have a great weekend as well.
Thank you, sweetie.
Okay, bye-bye.
How do I say goodbye to what we had? The good times that made us laugh outweighs the bad.
Good night, everybody.